Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here for Liberty Coalition Canada. And today I get to interview the most ironic guest on earth. And the most ironic guest on earth, that prize goes to Dr. Julie Panessi for this reason. Dr. Panessi is a professor of, am I right, bioethics?
Yes, bioethics, ethics, ancient philosophy.
Okay, bioethics, ethics, and ancient philosophy. And she was terminated with cause from Western University, Algonquin College.
Huron College.
For refusing to be coerced unethically into an experimental drug that is being distributed around this country unethically. So, Julie, I'm really sorry for what has happened to you. I tweeted the day that your video went viral and you made that announcement. I tweeted out, if this wasn't so tragic, the irony would be entertaining. Ethical ethics prof gets dismissed because she refuses to be unethically coerced. And friends, this is the day and the time in Canada.
This is our Canada. And so many people support these actions that we have exactly the same government we did before Monday.
Yes, the exact same government where you could hold a shirt and you could hold another shirt up of the exact same color. And you would say, I went shopping for a new shirt, and it would be the exact same thing. Not only that, Julie, but I was just learning this morning, voter turnout was horribly low in Canada. In fact, Trudeau won the same government with a million less votes this year. So again, good on you, Canadians. I know that our supporters probably already got out there and voted. I know those people who are in this conversation were active, and I do want to sincerely say good for you. But to those of you who sat at home and continue to let our country be taken over by a totalitarian dictator, you're going to get what you want. So, Julie, why don't you share with me about what has transpired with your life in the last number of weeks? Because you've gone from somebody that we got to talk openly a number of times to being a global viral hit.
I think in some sense, it feels like when we talked before, we were talking more theoretically, you know, about what in principle is going on. And we're facing these things down the road. We're facing employment mandates down the road or boosters down the road, you know, these things. But now it's become, you know, it's on our doorstep. It's the other shoe has dropped for me. And it's become very personal. Although I should say that even though it's become personal for me, I think it's resonated with a lot of other people because it's a common story, right? Feeling coerced to do something medically that you don't feel is right, and then suffering pretty significant, financial, social consequences because of that. So I don't quite know where we would have left off, but as the start of school got closer and closer, approaching the beginning of September, Western imposed a vaccination mandate that got more and more strict as we got closer to the start of term. So initially there could have been testing in lieu of vaccination, then they kind of closed that loophole, and then it was you had to upload proof of vaccination. There was a timeline to that, but basically by the middle of the fall it had to be done, and you have to wear a mask in class or teaching, which is kind of another issue in question. But if anyone has ever tried to do that and orate publicly to a class, my class would have been 100 and some people in an amphitheater. There are sort of practical challenges to that, let alone sort of moral ones, right? So anyway, I had sent a letter to my president, dean, and chair weeks before the start of school, outlining my general sorts of concerns from the perspective of an employee and an academic. So scientific concerns, ethical concerns, legal concerns, heard nothing back. And then as we got very close to the start of school, the dean wrote to say, so can we assume from this that you won't be complying with the mandate? I didn't respond to that letter because I knew that would basically clinch the termination, right? And I thought it's important that we try to negotiate to some degree here. But it became pretty clear for me personally that I wasn't willing to acquiesce to the mandate in any way. I don't think we ever should have been in the place where we're looking at vaccination mandates to address this viral situation. So I chose not to submit an exemption or accommodation request of any kind, and also made it clear to my dean that I wasn't going to upload vaccination status. One thing led to another. I was initially placed on temporary paid leave. Then the video came out, and that had an effect, I think, on the university's perception of me as an employee. And I, 2 weeks ago now, maybe a little less, got my termination with cause letter. That's where we're at.
There are so many places where we need to go. So first of all, I want to go to the exemptions and the applications. So
right.
We have been at Liberty Coalition Canada. We have been advising people to simply hand in a statement of your beliefs. And so on our website, we have a Christian Declaration for Medical Freedom Against Vaccine Coercion. We have a letter that we prepared with our chief litigator, James Kitchen, that we sent to every university in Canada. That was a demand for accommodation letter. Mm-hmm. So we have been encouraging people, this is all you need. You want someone to clearly state your beliefs. Okay. There are three pastors have written a Christian perspective on medical choice and medical freedom regarding vaccination and all of the reasons why people may have a conscience stricken position, mm-hmm. A conscientious dissent.
Yeah.
There it is. That, again, like three doctoral level pastors writing with all of their skill. And if you can sign that sincerely, there you go. And then secondly, we had a legal letter written up to warn these universities of how illegal their behavior was. Mm-hmm. And, people don't tend to, as you probably know, people are really looking for a silver bullet right now. So they're looking for, ooh, if I fill out this exemption form, it goes in and then it makes all of my problems go away. They don't realize that many of these exemption forms are a further contract of agreement to further medical coercion. If they ever test positively, they don't, all of those types of things.
Yeah.
We just said, look, show up on campus. And if anybody bugs you, give them those two things and say, mm-hmm. I demand to be accommodated. And
how's that working out?
Well, it's working out actually as well as people applying for exemptions. Nobody is accepting anything. These universities across the board are telling Bible-believing Christians, nope, you don't believe that. It's not good enough. And you don't have no exemption. Your conscience doesn't matter at all. Yeah.
There are a lot of interesting elements to this exemption situation. One is the question of if it's a religious exemption, and if you're Catholic, for example, and the Pope has already encouraged, shall I say, vaccination, the Catholics aren't having success getting exemption for that reason. Protestants, I've also heard anecdotally, have had a hard time getting exemptions. The biggest success seems to come from sort of the Muslim and Eastern religions, interestingly. Just a matter of fact, I'm in touch with a lot of people who have applied for them, and then they tell me if they've had success or not. I can't detect much of a pattern. From the cheap seats, I don't know what the process looks like internally at the universities or in the workplace, but there isn't a noticeable rational pattern in terms of, what people are providing and what is being given. In the medical context, the people who are submitting medical exemptions, employers, including universities and colleges, are in many cases rejecting them. And there are a lot of legal, this is outside my area of expertise, but there are a lot of legal implications to that. So when you have a non-medical person like a university administrator refusing the advice of, and I can think one case in particular of a neurologist who wrote a letter on behalf of a student who has certain conditions that would make vaccination especially problematic, being rejected, right? And then there's the issue of, when you get an exemption, there are concerns about whether or not you have the same legal rights as you did before you received or even submitted an exemption. And then there is, in my mind, sort of a broader legal and ethical question about the degree to which we feed into and support a system by asking to be made an exception to it, right?
Well, that is exactly why we struggled. We actually took the word exception out of all of our letters, because at the end of the day, it is ridiculous, utterly on its face. It is ridiculous for anyone to say, you believe that? Can you get a pastor to sign that you believe that? Like, I'm a pastor. I want my people to understand what the Bible says about things, but it is utterly ridiculous on its face for anyone outside of, I want to say outside of
an understanding of that, where you would be coming from.
I want to say outside of yourself, outside, like if someone has a legitimate, sincere belief, the practice of that belief does not fall outside of a criminal behavior.
Right.
That individual doesn't need to prove to anyone why that belief is, like, again, you're a secular university. You don't really believe in God anyways. Who are you to say that this is my Christian perspective? But even on that, if someone was in my church and making an argument to me about what they believed, even if I thought they were wrong, I most certainly could not say, but that's not your belief. And if I promise an exemption upon beliefs, then I must adhere to what I have promised that I would do.
I mean, my understanding of the reasoning behind allowing for this exemption on religious or creed grounds is that it allows for genuine objection that comes from within based on your personal beliefs, and that the evaluative process is supposed to focus on genuineness, not accuracy. Right. So what they're supposed to be looking for is, well, does this person truly hold, to truly demonstrate, you know, evidence of having thought about this and being personally connected? Is this part of this person's deeply held beliefs and principles? But we're not seeing that kind of evaluation strategy.
Right? But even if we were, think of of that. This is an investigation of the, I want to say this is the investigation of the mind. This is the Who is, like,
there's an intrusion from the state, right, into things that are deeply personal. And one of the reasons, like, why I think this is so problematic is that there is no one other than you yourself who will bear the negative consequences of these vaccines if they occur. The state won't bear them, the university won't bear them, and even if there was some compensatory mechanism, even if they paid you $3 million if you suffer from myocarditis, who cares? Money and health are incommensurable, right? They're not the same thing. You can't pay off someone's poor health status.
Right, so that's exactly right. This is someone saying, for my personal reasons, I want to be I do not want to take this. Mm. And that individual is the only person who will bear all of the consequences of that decision.
Yeah.
But furthermore, just going back to what we were talking about earlier, what I'm trying to get at is someone might have been pro-vaccine passports up until they saw your video. Mm. And they saw your video and they went, oh, wait a minute, I've never thought of it like that. And in that moment, changed their mind. Mm-hmm. Like I lived in Boston. I liked to cheer for the New England Patriots. When a popular player leaves that team and I say, oh, I'm a fan of that team, nobody, and especially no government, comes to me and says, no. Your obsession with that team as a fan, it's not been long enough. It hasn't been validated. It's not credible because, like, people's minds change. And especially now that this situation, it would be interesting for you and I to listen to our first interview where we were talking theory, when now you've been terminated. I've had to walk away from two positions over this issue. People's minds are going to change. And therefore, if I were to say to my university, yesterday I was ready to take the vaccine, but I did a bit of research and I changed my mind, and here are my, again, you got to remember, religion proper or religion ideology, because that's another side of things. I think atheism is as much a religion as Christianity is. Mm-hmm. An atheist's perspective is built as much on a system of beliefs as a traditional Judeo-Christian mm-hmm. worldview. Mm-hmm. So again, what are my religious beliefs? Well, they are my convictional ideology. That is it. Mm-hmm. So if yesterday I was pro-vax and today I realize, you know what? I read one article. I saw Dr. Julie's one video. I now understand the intensity of the situation. I'm going to step back. Nobody gets to investigate and say, no, you had to hold that conviction for 3.8 months before now we, the registrar of the university who sits behind a desk and gets paid to put people in a system and take them out, who has no particular wisdom into ethics or ideology or anything like that, I get to say to you, no, that's not a sincere and held belief. That's the point I was trying to make. It is so utterly dangerous.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I find really ironic about this is that what the mandate is trying to get you to do is to accept a medical treatment that is, well, we're kind of transitioning from this now, but until very recently have all been investigational by definition, right? The one grounds on which you cannot successfully get an exemption is because you object to the science. The state is not allowing people to question or object to having a medical treatment on the basis of their concerns about the scientific validity. And that is, you know, you said earlier, ironic at best, and I forget how you put it, but you know, that is, like, there's an irony to that, but there are great potential moral injuries to that, yeah, right? Again, for this reason, because you're gonna bear. So it seems as though there are problems with all of these reasons for seeking exemption, and they all have to do with the state interfering in our personal autonomous choices, and also expecting us to comply in the absence of transparency of information and the presentation of evidence. And if we want a state in which our government tells us, you must do this, or you're going to suffer these consequences, no, you may not ask questions, and no, you may not ask for evidence to be shown to you, we can live in that state, but we can't call it a democracy.
Certainly. And we can't call it freedom either in any sense of that word.
No.
And again, we can live there, but we've seen what it produces. And this is the thing that concerns me so much. We only have to look back into the recent 150 years of history, yeah, and see example after example where a centralized totalitarian, the expert knows best, and all in the name of science. You know, I've been studying my Cold War stuff. I've been studying my Stalin stuff. I've been studying my Mussolini stuff. I've been studying and it's all in the name of, this is the best for you and we can prove it to you, except we can't prove it to you and if you ask any questions.
Yeah, so there's something, I've been thinking a lot about this, you know, because I mean, bioethics for the last several decades is built on really the foundational idea of autonomy, and autonomy and rights are intimately connected. And when I and others in Canada are referencing various documents like our Healthcare Consent Act in Ontario, we're talking about informed consent, you have a right to informed consent. Well, that's true. And we have legislation about that. And, you know, much of bioethics and medical practice is built on that. But in some sense, that language, I think, is missing its audience, because, and I'm just kind of coming around to understanding this, when the messaging from the government that we're all in this together, do your part, right? This is collectivist language. So this is language that suggests that the rights of the individual are not important, or at least they're not important in an emergency, or they're not ultimately important. What's important is the common good. And I think, to bring it back to the university context for a minute, the young people now have been trained throughout their whole pre-post-secondary education and now also at university to be group oriented and subservient to authority. And there isn't, it's not even like there's a leader of the group, but the authority is the group itself, right? So we're almost sort of taught that as individuals, we don't have rights, our rights are not important, or our rights are somehow derived from the collective good or something like that, right? So there is no questioning of authority coming from large groups of our large percentage of our population, including young people, right? I've probably said this to you before, but when I was an undergrad, so in the mid to late 90s,
Yeah, it
in
really, yeah.
classes, it was like, it was just a free for all. It was like a brawl at a hockey game. Professors couldn't get everybody under control because we'd
Yeah.
talk about abortion and end of life, all these things, right?
Yeah.
Well, now, I mean, I've My biggest challenge as a professor is not how do I communicate this idea, it's how do I get things going because nobody cares or they're terrified of voicing an opinion. But this is the generation that is pushing for just do your part, just get the vaccine, just for the common good. So I think until we can sort of, I don't know if it's a matter of just understanding the commonality between the rights people and the collectivist people. Because sometimes that's it, right? Sometimes you realize that you have same fundamental values, but you just have a different way of implementing them or a different way of expressing them. I don't know if it's that or if those are fundamental differences, right? And unless we can find a way of addressing that, we're going to have this cleft, right? And so it isn't clear this is just a matter of figuring out, well, what are our medical rights? Let's stand up for those, and that's the end of it. Right? Because there's this socio-political drive towards collectivism that sees the signpost to rights and keeps driving, right?
I'm so glad you brought up this portion of the conversation and even in that context, because I think the missing narrative is who the individual is. So when we hear people tout a utilitarian ethic, which is greater good for the greatest number of people, that utilitarian ethic always has to, as it leads to its logical conclusion, it has to go totalitarian because it must be controlled. You cannot def A bunch of individuals cannot define the greater good for the greatest group. There has to be an elite that has control of the group to say this is it. This is why I've been comparing this. All of my listeners are probably tired of this, but I've just been comparing this to a schoolyard politics. Like, it is literally the bully has figured out what he wants to do, and he convinces everybody that doesn't want to get a punch in the face what's best for everybody, and then the group follows. The reason why I link this to the loss of understanding of the individual, because this is a very unique place. I am a pastor. I don't believe in my body, my choice in all of its applications. I don't believe in the rights movement, in the history of moving towards baby murder. It's a much more nuanced conversation for me. And I think this is the piece that's missing for everybody. And the piece is the intrinsic God-given value of every individual, and that when that individual is abused for the sake of the group, that is a moral wrong. And freedom, of course, is a tenuous, delicate pursuit because when individuals have freedom, because to act against them for the sake of a group and where someone is actually wronged, like what you're going through right now, it has to be balanced with a legitimate rule of law where individuals aren't allowed to do everything. So it is this. Now, again, the Christian worldview solves this problem perfectly. It's the individual is created in God's image, therefore every individual is is to be protected and carefully treated. But we all know what absolute morality looks like. And so everything a person wants to do is not necessarily right. And so here are your legal limits. And the biblical worldview produces a tremendous amount of freedom for the individual and law for society. But when you walk away from any deep philosophical or biblical understanding of the individual, you're left with the human imagination. And the human imagination, as you were saying earlier, tends to lead towards a collectivist utopian imagination of society.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, yeah, I'm saying it because I use it. You feel free to interact it.
I'm actually quite, I've said this to a number of other people, but I didn't see this coming, this sort of hardcore essentialist kind of collectivism. I mean, I know we've been in the every child gets a trophy era for quite a while, and I know that has led to some equalization of, sort of equality of outcome. And it's also probably, I think, led to grade inflation at universities, for example, because, you know, but that aside, I didn't see this collectivism coming. And one reason, so working from inside academia, is that utilitarianism that you mentioned, which for people who are watching, and if that's kind of a weird foreign term, it's just the idea that what you should do is that which maximizes the most amount of good for the greatest number of people, right? What's interesting about that is that utilitarianism is not the common view of academics or moral philosophers in particular. In fact, when I was a grad student at Western, we hired a token utilitarian, and that was a big deal because most of them are not. They're hard to find. It's like a rare species, right? And that's because I think it's not that it's clearly wrong or that there aren't some benefits to it. I mean, it sounds good, right? It sounds like more good, the better. Yay. Make more people happier. There you go. But the reason why it's often rejected is it's thought to gloss over the rights of the individual in ways that are really problematic. And medical ethicists in particular, I think, tend not to be utilitarian because they see the consequences of losing, right, that focus on the individual. And to come back to what we were talking about earlier, that it's the individual, I mean, you can be a collectivist all you want, but when it comes to physical and psychological harm, those are not things that are felt by a group. It doesn't even linguistically make sense to talk about, like, a group doesn't break its leg. A group doesn't get a heart attack. A group doesn't become a schizophrenic. I mean, those things might be true analogously. Like, you might be able to say metaphorically that, well, people in that town are kind of schizophrenic, but you can't make a diagnosis, right? Like, if you look at the DSM, so the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illness, it's all about diagnosing individuals, right?
Right. And what you just did was a stereotype, which is propaganda, and absolutely not like.
And nobody, I'm not saying, yeah, that's
No. But what I'm saying is, you and I would never permit that if that was said of us or our family or a general group.
It's derogatory. It's inaccurate.
That's right. It's actually just an ad hominem way of, we've talked about that before, of manipulation. So I understand exactly what you mean. And the irony, though, is I think you and I are both learning this year that ideologically or not, if people are not rigorously in belief of the value of the individual, they will follow utilitarian ways in order to save their own skin, which is exactly why you got terminated the day after the video went viral, or a week or two after, rather than prior, because you're now seeing a political response. You're seeing now a risk management of the university response.
Yes, I'm the one getting hung up in the square as a cautionary tale to others.
Of course.
If you don't comply, the same thing will happen to you. And by the way, if you choose not to comply, you better not state it confidently and publicly, because this is what we will do to you.
Yes.
Right.
Which again goes against every media leftist university narrative. Whatever happened 30 years ago of believing women, which, by the way, again, that was just a stupid slogan in order to win. Of course, we don't believe all women. Some women are virtuous and wonderful, and other women are lying scum, just like a bunch of men. Like,
Mike, you're going to get in trouble for that. I feel the emails coming at
right. But you understand, like the leftist universities that we have would have been sloganizing you a year or two ago if this was outside of any other topic. And that's why this is so concerning.
One thing that's been going on in academia and ethics and political philosophy and English and indigenous studies and things like this for a long time is attention to testimony and narrative and, right. and voices at the table, right? And so, and it being so important that we accept different kinds of presentation of data, right? So in the indigenous context, understanding that truth for them and relaying their tradition has to do with narrative and storytelling and connecting to the past and things like that, right? And we've worked so hard for so long to understand the value of storytelling and that not you know, that information that is presented as data or in the Western way is not the only way, right? And now we're seeing a complete homogenization of the way information must be presented, the source from which it must come, and what you must do with that information.
I think that as an outsider to that dialogue you're describing, I would think that the Hebraic way of understanding truth telling in the sense of one or two faithful witnesses, careful not to take bribery, understanding human corruption, and then having a judicial system or a bearing witness system that allows for dealing with, again, the human heart that is able to lie, and then other situations where the human heart is dying to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. As an outsider, it has bothered me, actually, within the world, within the academic world, where all types of truth-telling are deemed equal. Now it seems any form of truth telling is just deemed inappropriate. And I know where you are getting at. And the point you are making is that you've worked, the academic world has worked so hard in these areas. This is shocking to you. I'm kind of thinking of it as an outsider going, it's actually not that shocking to me. When you strike down historically valid forms of making sure that a human being is telling the truth, you have a rigorous way of discovering truth from falsehood. And so in your situation, there's a very easy way. Like I was defending you online the other day. I'm embarrassed to tell you about this, but I was defending you online from a man who used to be a pastor, and the way that he just accepted a few others' slanderous words of you and discredited you online was atrocious. And I called him out for it, and I will continue to do it until he repents of his gossip and stupidity. But your testimony
is sweet.
Well, no, like your testimony is easy to validate. Like it's pretty simple. I'm an ethics prof. I've studied ethics. Yes. Hand up on the Bible. Yes.
I have worries.
Is there anything that you're concerned about ethically? Yes. What would those be? Okay. Here's one. Here's two. Here's three. Here's four. Do you have any witnesses to validate your concerns? Yes. I'm networked with a whole group of physicians that have felt like physicians and scientists who have been silenced. Here's work. At the end of the day, in a criminal court, whether or not the judge believes you or not, or the jury believes you or not, or agrees with you or not, they would have to permit, what is that legal phrase, where beyond a shadow of a doubt, they would not be able to, if they wanted to go against you, they couldn't, because you would have been providing evidence. But then if they were testing you as to a true witness, there it is. Like, do you have any personal concerns? Yes, I do. Do you have any reason to have those? Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think both of us are just learning the world of politics and the world of individuals going along with the flow.
I've thought about this a lot, you know, because some of the harshest comments I've gotten is that, well, this is not what ethics is about, right? Ethics is about the common good. Ethics is about helping people and doing things that are good for people. And I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean,
That's
my
an interesting assumption.
interesting assumption. Yeah.
You're
My view
already
about
assuming a collectivist response to ethical
that's right.
inquiry.
Yeah. So then their view is, well, how do you best help people in a group? But they're right. They're begging the question because they're assuming that's what you're trying to do. In some sense, I think that, the term or the label teacher of ethics is a bit wrong-headed, because in ethics, I don't take it to be, it's not didactic in the same way that some other disciplines are, right? What I take to be the most important sort of fulcrum of the ethical discipline is figuring out what questions are important, what questions we should be asking, right? So a question that is very compelling to me is, what is the best kind of character and how do you develop it? Right? Because I have a background in Aristotle and he was a character ethicist. I'm very interested in what he has to say about that. And but even when you ask that, what is the best kind of character, then even in that, you're sort of assuming that there's some value to that character, right? But and another question that I like to ask students is, well, what would you do if you knew nobody was looking? I think there's a lot of, right? Because right now we have so much virtue signaling among people that it's very hard, I think, to separate, and maybe probably even for individuals ourselves, to separate what we think we ought to be doing from how we want to be perceived by other people. And this language of collectivism, I mean, let's assume for the sake of argument that it is our moral obligation to act for the group, right? So let's assume in this COVID context that we should be doing what will be most likely to reduce the transmission of COVID in the group or something. Let's assume that for the sake of argument. Well, the scientific data itself, let alone the moral stuff, but science doesn't show that what we're doing is best, right? I just came across, there was a series of graphs that came out, I think it was on the 21st of September, so really recent, showing the countries that have the highest number of cases per million of COVID. And Israel's number one, and Israel is the third or fourth most vaccinated country behind Gibraltar and Uruguay and one other place, I think. Most vaccinated, highest number of COVID cases. So we are, right? I mean, we're seeing that, like, vaccination is not necessarily stopping transmission. It isn't necessarily reducing severity of symptoms, because vaccinated people can still become infected. They can still transmit. So we're looking at this vaccination passport issue. The purpose of the passports is, and the mandates can't be to identify people who are immune. There's that really interesting question about whether or not vaccinated means immune, because people who have natural immunity, and I can't remember who said this the other day, it was one of the scientists from the States that said that half, it seems like about half the people in America would have natural immunity, right? And that natural immunity is more robust because you develop non-specific antibodies. So the people who have gotten vaccinated, who have these specific antibodies that can tackle only one variant of the virus, are actually far more likely to develop a variant. I mean, so all of that, I mean, this doesn't need to be a discussion about the science behind COVID and vaccination, but my point is that there's a moral question about whether or not you should be acting for the sake of the group. And then you're not off the hook in terms of answering the scientific question about what will best help you to help the group, right? And my personal view is that vaccine mandates, vaccine passports with this particular set of COVID vaccines aren't doing either very well. They're not only respecting individual rights, but they're not benefiting the group either. So why in the world are we doing them? There's a question for Teresa Tam. I'd like her to answer that. Are you having her on your show? I'm sure she'd love to talk to you.
I would welcome her on my show at any time to discuss why she is choosing to direct our country in the way that she is doing it. I too want to just jump in there a little bit on the science. I've had the privilege to interview Dr. Byron Bridle. I've had the privilege of interviewing a woman from California named Karen Kingston.
Yes, I just watched a video by her the other day. My goodness.
Well, so if you're talking about the actual study, she showed me within the Pfizer study that if you got vaccinated, that the nature of the vaccination itself means that you are a potential carrier and spreader. That the actual study protocol required that if you were vaccinated and you couldn't go into contact with a pregnant woman, you couldn't have, men couldn't have sexual intimacy with a woman who was menstruating. Like there were very specific protocol within their phase three studies that would actually demonstrate that those people who are running it around right now and getting vaccinated for a time themselves are contagious. And that is within their own. Now, the word that they use is shedding. And I remember her pre-interview, we just started talking and she said, like, I'd really like to explain shedding. And I thought, oh, I really am glad to have a scientist she was in big pharma. I really want someone to be able to explain this to me, because of course, shedding is one of those things where
we had bad word.
And we had people on it months and months ago. And when just the average Joe is trying to explain shedding, you're trying to get your head around it.
Yeah.
And she explained it so well that you walk away and you go, oh, okay. So like within their own protocols, people who are getting vaccinated should be quarantining for a time because they are potentially contagious, that they should be following their own rules based upon these. So it's just another area, but I want to link that to the collectivist conversation, because I think this is really important. This is where I'm going to be more pastoral than academic, because academics, you are the perfect academic, Julie, when you say, I want to pose questions. I want to offer questions and force my student to, well, I'm a pastor. I don't want people to have a whole lot of questions. I want them to have a question and then I want to give them an answer. The answer is that the reason why this is not being sufficient for either the individual or the medical reasons, mm-hmm. because when you have a collectivist mindset, you have got to rule from the top, and whatever narrative that is, it has to be intact. You have to stick with it mm-hmm. until your desired outcome is achieved. And if your desired outcome is 100% of Canadians being vaccinated, and then 6 months later, we're still dealing with COVID-19.
You have to hold on to that.
You mm-hmm. have to create a logical scapegoat, which from the day that we know, right? Remember when Adam and Eve are in the garden and mm-hmm. God shows up and says to Adam, hey, where you guys been hiding? What's going on? And Adam says, well, we ate from the tree you told us not to eat from. And it was the woman that you gave me. Adam gives two scapegoats, God himself and his lovely wife. So that's the two systems you need for collectivism to work from the top. You always need to stick to your narrative, and you always need a scapegoat when your narrative doesn't add up to the results that you're promising the community. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're facing, because I've not person who's vaccine hesitant, who hasn't researched this, who hasn't thought it through, who hasn't been careful. In fact, the opposite is true. People who I ask, you know, did you go vaccinated? Sure, I went. What's in it? I don't know. Are you concerned about it? Like, this side is far more researched, both on the moral issue and the medical issue, mm-hmm. than this side.
One of the things that really kind of tipped me off to this collectivism thing, I feel like I'm a little late to the party, that some other people have taken this as a given for a while now, but it just seems to be kind of coalescing in
my
mind.
You're a true academic. Academics are always late.
Slow on the update. Yeah. But one of the things that really tipped me off is when it started to become very clear, not that we weren't presenting the right evidence to the right people, but that there was no interest in looking at it because that's not important. Right? Because exactly as you say, what's important is following the authority, not for the reasons that make that person a genuine authority, right? So following authority is not necessarily bad. You know, I mean, when you go to a specialist, you have a heart problem and you say, cardiologist, you've studied this much more than I have. I appreciate your opinion, you know, tell me about this. So there are justified cases of taking the advice of an authority. But when you follow the advice of an authority, When you don't know anything about that person's credentials, and you don't care if they have credentials, and you don't care that they're not offering you an explanation, then you know that this kind of collectivism mindset is at work. And I think until we understand that better and understand how to communicate with people with that mindset and to come to some kind of agreement or to show them why that mindset is ultimately going to be problematic or whatever. So this is, again, I think a socio-political, moral, religious kind of battle, spiritual battle, not, it's not, the scientific debates are intractable.
So, and going to what you just said, and I want to let you know, everyone's going to scold me. They're going to be like, you had Dr. Julie on and she's brilliant. Why did you keep talking? But what you just said there is so important. Like, by the way, if I do go to a specialist and they want me to take a certain medication, I can still say no.
Yes, exactly. You can still, and you might, and it might only be because you don't have a great feeling about it.
And I might die tomorrow and I could still say no.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if I'm in there and that doctor isn't quite answering my questions the way that I'd like to, do you know what
Yeah.
else I can do in this country?
Go to another person.
I can go to another doctor and get a second opinion. And do you know what? If I do that, sometimes that second opinion differs from the first opinion.
Yeah. And we're allowed to weigh
Except when it comes to an experimental vaccination
the
over
That's right.
something that I'm not worried about, even in the slightest, for my own personhood.
You know, I think if you take in the example of talking to a specialist and whether or not to accept their advice, your own what they're giving you is filtered through a certain kind of lens, right? So if you go to that cardiologist or you know, cancers, I think, are a really good example because what cancer physicians will often kind of advice they will give you is pharmacological often, right? And predictions based on usually life extension measures, right? But it's up to the individual to decide whether or not quantity or quality of life is more important. That's a personal value decision. And so you need to filter the kind of scientific expertise you're getting and fit that into your own personal belief system and set of principles. And that quite legitimately will look different for different people. So some people may feel that it's important for me to live as long as possible because I don't know, I want to be able to see my daughter have her wedding. I want to see my grandchildren, or maybe I have projects I want to do, or and maybe it's less important to them what their quality of life. But other people will quite legitimately feel like, well, I don't want to live purely for the sake of extending my life. So anyway, when it comes to the COVID situation, we should simultaneously allow people to make decisions on the basis of their values and also on the basis of our risk aversion, right? So some people are very hypochondriacal and they fear a virus more than anything else, and maybe it's rational for them to do what they take to be necessary in order to minimize that risk, right? And others of us, maybe we have more of a natural approach to healthcare, and we would rather take our chances with the natural world and natural immunity. But the beautiful thing about Canada is supposed to have been that it's possible to allow for those multiple points of view. And I can just hear my objectors, though, they're in the background saying, well, hold on, because this isn't just about you. What you do affects other people. And again, we're kind of back to the science again, because you know, as a very wise lawyer friend told me, this is just a logical situation. If the vaccines work, you take it. It's no one else's business. If they don't work, they shouldn't be mandated. Right? So again, we're kind of back.
Stand-up comedy bits about that, like when Justin Trudeau says you can't get on a plane or train to get to put the vaccinated at risk. Sorry, just finish that out again. I went and got vaccinated for what purpose? So that I wouldn't be at risk. And at risk for what? So even if you go to the lowest selling point.
I don't know if that's the answer, Mike. I think it depends, right? Because I think some people will say, I got vaccinated for you.
Well,
Well,
no,
you
that's
didn't have
fair.
a
But what
lot.
I'm saying is the logic of an 80% of the country being vaccinated and then the 20% being a threat to them. The lowest selling point of the vaccine is that it lowers
Severity and
hospitalization risks, it lowers the severity. So it went from a common cold to the average person to like even less than that for the average person. And for those who are in high target areas, it might lower that. Even with that being your selling point, it makes no logical sense for either you to go get vaccinated and then live in fear,
Right.
or for you to go get vaccinated at all if it doesn't do anything. But I want to go back again right before you dealt with your opponents there, and you said, I know what they're thinking and saying, this is not all about you.
Because it's about transmission and harming others.
Before we get there, I want to go back to how deeply the conscience of the individual is connected to these decisions. So some people are more risk adverse because we believe in life after death. Like I might legitimately run out into a crowd of dying people knowing that I could die because I have a faith in life after death that someone who doesn't believe in life after death might never do. Like, this is where our belief systems really inform our deeply held ideas, our decision that could have, I could have made that change last night, right? Like, what was it like for our grandparents who, our grandfathers who one day were not going to the war, went down and said, you know what, I'm seeing all the other guys sign up, I'm going to go do it. And they went from one moment to the next moment, I was not going to war, and now I am. That's a pretty sincerely held belief that they made, and they just had a new perspective. So I just want, before we move on again, because you're absolutely right, the science does not even demonstrate that what we're doing is right. But even if it did, the collectivist mood will never permit the exploration of that type of science.
I think that's right. But I think the collectivist is also pretty good at shooting himself in the foot, or shooting the group in the foot, I guess it would be. Right? Because if
Well,
we just
so, like,
have
literally, the
because if we
collectivist
just have kind of
always
a
has to start shooting the group.
Yeah. Well, if we have just a blind allegiance to what we believe is best for the group, and we don't allow for dissenting opinions or multiple voices, we don't allow questioning. It's not guaranteed. It's not clear that you will be on the path that is best for the group, unless you define what's best for the group as just holding the belief that you're acting in
But
the way
again,
that's
no,
best for the group. I don't know.
maybe I'm just further down my passion for history on this one. But even in that state, you end up having to shoot people to stay in the group. So, number one, if your decisions are leading to injury, which they always do, then number two, the dissenters try to leave and you make examples of them. I can think of a ethics prof from a certain university when I think of a being made an example of. But then when the mob actually starts waking up to what's going on, I remember listening to a podcast called The Cold War and What We Learned. And the podcaster ended up marrying a Russian woman. And he said, I started out shooting this podcast, kind of looking at the Western perspective. But because of my wife's background, I actually found that I had access to a tremendous amount of Russian resources. And I started thinking about this from the Russian perspective. And he said, the one thing that an American or a Westerner cannot understand is the Easterners struggle with being more scared of the enemies inside their borders than being scared of the enemies outside of their borders. Like, you and I are really getting down the road of political theory. We're getting down the road of looking at history. But the point is that the collective, all it's your fault because you said shoot in the foot and then shoot the crowd. But that's literally what has to happen. The philosophy ends up proving to be absolutely nothing about what it promised. And then when people start reacting to those broken promises, that is when the might is right ends up coming out. And you literally have to shoot people to keep them in your country or to silence the rest of the mob from growing up. And so we're on dangerous ground. Like, we are on very, very dangerous ground when an ethics professor in Ontario can be dismissed simply for having ethical questions. And I'm so sorry how you've been treated. And I'm so glad that you and I met long before you were a celebrity, because I got to see your genuine competency, your sincerity, your thought processes long before it became political. You and I were talking about this, I think it was almost a year ago, we were talking about this.
Could be. Yeah. Well, it's in some sense, I don't think a reasonable person would ever wish to go through what I have gone through and will probably always be known for this in some sense. I think, the way the internet is, anytime someone Googles my name, which is a fairly unique name, this will come up, right? Good or bad, it will follow me forever. But the silver lining to that, and maybe something even more powerful than that, is that I don't think we live in a time where silent compliance is useful in any way. I think it's actually quite useless. I may have told you this before, but there was this article, I think it was in 2011, Science Daily, and it stated that you only need 10% of the people to hold an idea for it to spread like wildfire. But that 10% can't hold the idea silently, right? You kind of have to hold it up and say, this is what I think, and this is how my actions are going to change on the basis of what I think. And that doesn't mean I'm going to just sort of, steamroll anyone in my path. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be, closed to revision if I get new information or experience dialogue with someone who has something interesting to say. I might revise my thinking about certain things, but it does mean that I'm willing to say, when I go out into the world publicly speaking, or now in Zoom conversations publicly speaking, that I'm going to act consistently with my beliefs. And that's what, like, technically, this is what integrity means, right? It means that there'll be consistency between what I believe and what I do. And what I believe might be wrong, but at the very least, I hope that there's that kind of consistency. And I think now we need people to say, I think what the government's doing is wrong. I think what this kind of public face of science or public health is doing is overstepping into individuals' lives in a way that is harming the individual and is harming the group. And this is what I'm going to do on account of it. I was talking to a physician this morning from a small town in Ontario, and she said, I resigned over this. Another physician said, the only way, I'm going to take one of these shots is if you hold me down with 10 police officers. We need people to not comply. If that's your belief, right? I'm not saying that's what you have to do, but if that's your belief, not comply, say you're not complying, and have your actions follow what you do. I've also talked to a lot of people said, well, I guess I don't have a choice. I guess I'm just getting the vaccine. I guess I'll just go with the flow. I guess I'll just do what my husband wants, all of these things. And that kind of complacency, in my view, and I don't mean to sound harsh about this, but that's what's gotten us to this point. And if we want to reclaim what set Canada onto this, revolutionary plane in terms of freedom and democracy, if we want to get back to that, we have to be a little bit more like I think the American Revolutionary Fathers were. We have to be a little less polite, a little less worried about etiquette and getting along with everybody, and a little more worried about thinking for ourselves about what's right and then making very clear-headed commitments to acting in accordance with those beliefs, come what may. And unfortunately, these days, what will come may be pretty terrible, but it's up to us to make those decisions about what's most important.
So, Julie, thank you so much for being with us. It was great to have you again. I'm sure we'll talk soon. I'm praying for you on a daily basis. I'm praying you have courage and that you will endure all the false things being said about you.
Well, thank you, Mike, as always, because I think that media and keeping the conversation going is an essential part of democracy. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Okay, everybody, have a great day. Godspeed.
Thanks for tuning in to this Liberty Coalition Canada interview, a united front to restore liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and Rumble channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com.